I was fortunate in 1993 to go through the grazing for profit course and come across the concept of cell grazing and measuring and monitoring, measuring how much grass we've got in our paddocks, recording how much we're consuming out of the paddocks, and the concept of feed budgeting. So at the end of the growing season, which for us up here traditionally was the end of March, it's no longer that. It's shifted. The goalposts have shifted. It can be, we can have growing season up here now until the end of June. And our green season traditionally is the beginning of November. And that the goalposts there also shifted. It can not start until this year. It didn't start until March. So I didn't have to do much lawn mowing up here until March. But I guess underneath all that, yes, we've got these shifting goalposts, but underneath all that, if we're in the grazing industry, then we make our money out of turning sunlight into grass and then turning that grass into kilograms of beef or lamb or whatever animals we're grazing. So then I guess it's no different to owning a shop. If we open the doors, we need to know we've got so many cartons of baked beans or so many pounds of butter to sell or so many litres of milk. It'd be no good opening the shop every day if we had no milk in the fridge and no butter and no baked beans. We wouldn't be able to provide that service and that food to our customers. So then if we look at our grazing animals as our customer that is eating the sunlight we've turned into grass, then if we haven't got any grass, then what are we doing with livestock there? So we need to, I guess, get into a space of measuring how much grass we've got. So when I was on the old farm at Theodore, Duke's Plain, every end of March, we would go around and basically estimate how much standing feed we had in the paddocks. We would look at how many livestock we had in terms of a large stock unit, or if you're in the sheep industry, a DSE. And then project forward to the beginning of the green season for us, which was November, and see whether the standing feed in our paddocks in stock days per hectare matched up to the number of animals we had at the time. If it didn't match up, then we either needed to buy cattle in or sell cattle. So in end of March, we could do a six-month projection, which was up here is our dry season. We could say, okay, I've got sufficient standing feed to take me through until the green season, or I haven't got sufficient feed. And so then we can start to plan numbers adjustment, being fully, I guess, informed about how many baked beans, how much milk, how many pounds of butter we had in the fridge. Simple process, and I guess it's something that largely is being neglected right across our rural industry. And I see a lot of what I was doing in 93 when I went to the grazing for profit school. I'd spent 10 years building my herd up. I'd finally got my herd, this many breeders, I was going to produce this many Japox. And I found myself looking into the southwest for where the storms were. It had stopped raining and I was running short of grass. So I was in that, oh, it's got to rain soon process. And I've got to preserve, these are my breeders, these are my internal cattle. This is my whole business. And I went to do the grazing for profit workshop and it jolted me into reality that I didn't have any business having cattle if I didn't have sufficient grass for them. So when I arrived home after that workshop, I made two phone calls. One was to the agent, the other one was to the trucking company. And within a matter of weeks, I'd reduced from probably 1,000 head down to 250 head of animals. It totally shattered my vision of having 500 breeders and turning off their progeny of Japox. For the next 3 years, I religiously feed budgeted and bought and sold cattle. In that 3 year period, it was below average rainfall. In that 3 year period, I never did get one animal up to market specifications, so I never finished one animal. But I traded a lot of animals in that period. I would buy animals in, I'd eat the grass I had available, I would sell them. And I just kept churning numbers. And at the end of 3 years, went through the benchmarking process called ProfitProbe, which Resource Consulting Service had just kind of developed and was playing with. And the interesting thing was my profitability of the business was up, purely driven by turnover. It wasn't driven by having the best Japox or finishing animals. It wasn't driven by having the perfect breed mob of breeding cows and having the perfect genetics. It was purely profit driven by turnover. So that was a real lesson to me in the value of feed budgeting and managing my farm and managing my grass and being prepared to sacrifice the animals because the animals were not the main game. My main game was turning sunshine into grass and then having that grass turn into kilograms of feed. It's a very humbling exercise, but it stood me in good stead ever since.
Well, Shane, the key thing is that farmers really must do what you just said and really not treat their stud animals as something that they've just got to keep going, because the farmers who don't do what you've done have spent ginormous amounts of money. Like one particular farmer was going to spend $800,000 on feed. Now, all right, they had 2,000 hectares, but that's something that you could have gone down the track in your previous farm to have done that. And so what you just said, that you didn't have to do that. So it's a quite a mental exercise to do what you did do, and instead of having feeding and sacrifice paddocks and other and whatever else. So Shane, can you just keep talking on that matter?
Yeah, Hugo, I guess that what I see in it now in following that strategy, I had to have zero emotional ties to my livestock. I couldn't be tied to my genetics or my particular breed. They need to be totally saleable, all of them, at any time. And I guess that the rule one is thou shalt not drought feed. So there's absolutely no leeway in my business to go and purchase hay or grain to feed stock with. That is not even a thought in the process. And I guess that in selling the animals, I've converted those animals into dollars. Then I've taken that and repositioned it somewhere else. So it may terrify your accountant, it may terrify your bank manager. And I guess that's to me as being somebody who's in the grazing industry, there was a real need for me to learn some off-farm investment skills. Not be sucked into the storm financials and the get-rich-quick guys that are out there selling schemes, but to, I guess, develop a little financial literacy or investment literacy myself.
Mm-hmm.
So that then when I was working through, don't get me wrong, I still work through advisors. I don't do all the investing myself, but I can now make an assessment on whoever's advising me. And if I think they're pulling the wrong rein, then I'll let them know that I'm aware of what they're doing and try and keep them on the right track. But I guess one of the real benefits in downsizing my cattle herds is I had less to do. I had less water to pump. I had less livestock to look after. I wasn't feeding. I had less stress in my life, and I had a lot more time to go to the beach. So then at the end of the, when the rains came, I was in good financial health. I was in good mental and physical health. And I was ready to get up and go again, and my landscape was ready to get up and go. And that was the thing at the beginning of the process, what I learned from the Grazing for Profit workshop, was it's possible to set yourself a goal that your landscape, your pastures, your soil will be in better condition at the end of the drought than it was at the beginning. Now that's a real head smasher, that one.
Yeah. Shane, the huge benefit that you have illustrated is that you've lifted the carbon on the soil, and you've lifted or increased the water holding capacity on the property. So can you sort of match that into what we're talking as far as grazing management, stock holding, and the end benefit of, as you say, the ecology of your farm has just moved astronomically.
Yeah, and I'm just having a quick squeeze into my phone here because I've got some notes there that on water holding capacity and infiltration rates, but basically, you know, I'm saying now that I'm gambling by being overstocked and waiting for it to rain. But here we go. I've got the number. I found my numbers here. On trials that were done, this was in West Australia with water infiltration, on bare ground, 25 millimetres per hour infiltration, ground with litter on it, so with some organic matter sitting on top, the infiltration was 45, almost double the bare ground. And then with a perennial grass tussock, 175 millimetres per hour.
Huge difference between 25.
Yeah, so, yeah, seven times as much as on bare ground. And so when I drive around the country now, I've recently been down around Armidale, and the amount of bare ground I see down there, it is frightening. If they get rain down there, and you think in terms of that landscape on the New England tableland, infiltrating 25 millimetres an hour, if they get 100 or 200 millimetre fall, where's all the water going to end up?
Well, it's creating damage.
Down the bottom of the hill somewhere, and it'll take a lot of soil and nutrient with it. The interesting thing about this infiltration thing was they then repeated a second time. On the bare ground, the infiltration rate dropped to 12 mils per hour. On the litter, it dropped to 30 mils per hour. And on the perennial grass, it went up to 300 millimetres per hour. So if we can maintain a perennial grass tussocks across our landscape, it is so important in terms of recovery from drought and capturing whatever rainfall comes along. The next set of numbers I have here, these are kind of like my benchmark numbers that I work off religiously. And this one's to do with organic matter levels. So you take 100 kilograms of soil with 4 to 5% organic matter, it will hold 200 kilograms of water. The same 100 kilograms of soil with 1.5 to 2% organic matter will only hold 45 kilograms of water. So a quarter, less than a quarter of what where you've got. And on Duke's Plain, we had our organic matter levels up on top side at 5%.
Yeah.
So you can get a glimpse there of, we had perennial grasses all over the place. I had a thing of zero bare ground, 100% ground cover, perennial grasses, high organic matter levels. You can get a glimpse of we were capturing that 175 millimetres per hour or the second fall 300 mils per hour in the soil, and we're having a water holding capacity in 100 kilograms of soil of 200 litres of water, 200 kilograms of water. And it just goes on from there. The next trials, kill that. the next one is to do with rest in the beginning of the growing season. These trials were done in Africa. When we had no rest to a pasture in that first 60 days of the growing season, the root depth was 30 centimetres. So I think that's, I don't know how many centimetres, but if you can imagine, that's the root depth.
Yep.
This is funny working with a camera because you have to move in the opposite direction of what you think. But if you can imagine, you can imagine, yeah, 30 centimetres. Now, if you rest the same pasture for 60 days, in the beginning of the growing season, the roots go down 120 centimetres, so four times the depth.
Mm.
So I'm capturing the rainfall with infiltration rate, I'm holding it with organic matter, and I'm resting my pasture, so I'm getting deeper root systems, so I'm farming in four times as much soil. And this is where the whole thing starts to really gather some horsepower. And if we look at the ultimate, like a compost, a good compost will hold 900% of its volume in water. A clay will hold 20%, and the sand will hold 2%. That's by weight. So, you know, I just live by these numbers, and I guess that when I put livestock into a paddock, I picked this question up from somewhere. I don't know where it came from, but basically it was, what will this grazing event do to improve the state of the soil and the pasture? So if we find ourselves hanging on to cattle when it's not raining, and like I'm doing now, doing a gamble, I know that when I put my livestock into a paddock, they're actually in some ways taking it backwards. So I then have to say, well, what are the opportunities in here that I can get out of this? And like in my bluegrass country, I'm really opening it up and getting a massive legumes coming through. So we can turn the silk purse in, of sow's ear into a silk purse, but we need to be aware, I guess, of all those measures of water infiltration, of soil organic matter, of resting of the pasture and what it does to the roots. And so what I'm doing this year here, where I'm gambling with too many animals, I won't repeat it next year or the year after. It's just a kind of a one-off event. I've actually, with the surplus grass, I've actually put that in the bank I bale hay and I put the money in the bank. So I can actually sell cattle now and lose money on the cattle, but I've already banked the grass by making it into hay and selling it.
Right.
So yeah, I'm aware of what I'm doing. I know that what I'm doing is in some respects detrimental to the landscape, but it's a calculated risk that I'm taking, which I normally don't do. I'm normally fairly conservative when it comes to my grazing management. And I decided this year I'd take myself out to the end of the limb a little bit and push the boundaries. And it just, the need for flexibility in what we're doing and awareness of the results of it is so important. Yeah. So I'm not making out that what I'm doing is perfect. It's just that I'm aware of the consequences of what I'm doing, and that I am gambling, but I kind of know the rules of how the deck's stacked.
So Shane, you know the rules, but you also know the principles, and farmers really have got to have those principles firmly in their minds, and you're talking about continually gambling. You're sort of gambling with a bit of pocket money rather than gambling with a ginormous debt that these farmers have, to the point that they some even lose their lives because of that. So that's the horrendous part. And Shane, I'd like you to keep talking about this because to make it clear, but the next subject which you would like to go into is probably 12,000 odd years that farmers have been sort of trained to get rid of so-called unnecessary vegetation like trees. And you explained, found that the trees are actually productive. And that might, hopefully from this conversation, I'd like you to continue talking about what you have been just talking about to have the points clear for farmers. But the next thing is maybe you can sort of lead into the value of trees and syntropic farming. Your woodlands farmers and woodlands just don't go together as in the past.
Yeah, Hugo, grazing and cropping and trees don't go together, and there's plenty of science to back that up. Unfortunately, the science is quite flawed. I guess that my experience with trees began in the early 1970s, and I started reading information on alley cropping. So it was very specific to cereal cropping and reduction of 70% in surface evaporation, and actually people producing increased yields off less country because of the protection that the shelter belts or the tree alleys gave to the crop. Unfortunately, when we do the science or when we observe, we tend to look right next to the trees where the trees are competing with the crop for moisture. And we don't look at the big picture. The trial work we did at Duke's Plain with grazing and trees, we established there that the optimum was to have our tree lines 60 metres apart. And then we were picking up production away from the trees. We got out to a certain distance and then it started to drop off again. So we established that 60 metre cleared strips. So basically 30 metres of trees and 60 metres of clear. So a third of trees and two thirds of open grassland was the optimum. Quite interestingly, we tripped on that through gut feeling or intuition when we were clearing, and then later on the science backed up that intuition. One of my brother's place, the Landcare Group, did some trials there, and they found that the grass under the trees was higher protein. So the cattle obviously hunt, or grazing animals go for that grass under the trees because it's high protein. And if we've got the animals there on a continuous graze basis, with, you know, where we're not providing sufficient rest, then that grass under the trees continually gets hammered and loses its vigour and often dies out. And then we come along and we see the tree with no grass underneath it, and we say the tree's the problem. And so that we got rid of the tree. Then our science showed us we had a big bulge in grass production due to the grass being able to feed off that built up soil biology from the trees. But they didn't run the experiment for long enough to demonstrate that it actually ran down after a few years. And we ended up going down the hole. And that was when, when all the different mechanical means and artificial fertilizer means were coming into vogue. So we just started piling on these external inputs, whether we plowed and reseeded, whether we ripped it, whether we threw phosphate fertilizer or urea at it. And I guess that we're in a space now where we've seen the rundown of the country that that's been done to, and it just takes it further and further down the hole. So I guess the work I did at Duke's Plain, where I let the trees come back into the landscape, and we were yield recording there, grazing yield recording there for, now it's been since 1995. So we've got quite a bank of data there. At about 21 years, we crunched the numbers on it. And surprise, surprise, our heavily timbered country was our highest yielding country. Mm-hmm. The country that we'd re-cleared, and there was some 800 hectares we'd re-cleared for cereal cropping and then put back to grass. So we got rid of the trees off it. The increase in yield on one land type was minute. On another land type, it was a decrease in yield. And when we put them together and looked at the return on investment, like how long it would take to get back the cost of re-clearing and repasturing it, it was a multi-generational exercise. It was going to take something like 97 years to get the money back that we'd spent.
Yeah.
So that was a an interesting and quite humbling experience. And I'm still only a few days ago I was talking to somebody who's clearing country just north of here at Maribyrnong. And I said, turn your tractor off. And I had another young guy here the other day, same thing, he's clear. I said, turn your tractor off, put your axe away. Collect your figures on what's actually going on. And find the space where you can actually optimize your trees and your grass production and your tree canopy. And one of the observations I've been making over through this widespread and severe drought that we're having, as I drive around in the landscape, our landscapes with no trees on them are brown and bare, so there's no photosynthesis happening. Now we're all aware of the, we're all now